At Can't Stop Endurance, we work with runners from beginner to advanced. From rookies to marathon champions, we provide personalized coaching to help endurance athletes reach their personal goals. Whether it's a 5K or 100-mile ultra, we have been there as coaches and athletes. I'm Coach Holly, and now here's Coach Kevin Leathers.
Hey, Coach Holly, how are you today?
I'm living it up still.
It's great, right? The season's over. We're going into summer racing. And today we get to do one of our favorite things on the podcast.
Talk to a special guest who specializes in something that we all need to know more about.
You know, nutrition, as a lifelong endurance athlete, you kind of think of yourself as an amateur physical therapist, an amateur nutritionist, but we're really not. We're really just trying to figure it out as we go. And we get a lot of questions from our runners. So nutrition is a really big topic that we want to better understand. And we came across our guest today on Instagram. Her Instagram name is The Endurance Nutritionist. So followed her, really interesting stuff. So today we're going to bring in one of our community partner experts. Kristen Fant is a registered dietitian. She's a distance runner based in Dallas, Texas. And she focuses on helping runners and triathletes fuel for performance and avoiding injury without feeling anxious and overwhelmed when it comes to nutrition. Did that sound familiar, Holly?
Absolutely, 100%.
Right. And she also helps people overcome disordered eating behaviors. And when she's not training for races, she loves spending time outdoors. She loves planning her next travel adventure, trying out new recipes. So I think we're going to get along very well. Kristen Fant, welcome to the Can't Stop Endurance podcast.
Hi, thanks for having me. Happy to be here.
Oh, we're excited to dig in today and really pick your brain on a variety of topics. Let's get started by just tell us about your sports or fitness background, how you got started, and then what led you into nutrition as your career.
Okay. Well, it's a little bit of a roundabout story. So I know a lot of runners, you know, ran cross country in high school or maybe in college. I ran 1 year of cross country in middle school, and it was a really terrible experience. And I really hated it. Here in Texas, obviously cross country season is in the summer, and it's a really unpleasant time to be running outdoors at 3:30 in the afternoon, which is when our practices were. So
yeah, I know.
So after that, I was like, I don't think running is for me. And then later when I was in college, I was studying abroad, didn't have access to a gym, and decided to start running again to, you know, get some exercise, see the city that I was living in. And from there, just kind of blossomed into somebody who really enjoyed running. So I ran my first half marathon in 2011. I ran my first full marathon in 2013. I've run several more since then. And so it's definitely become something that's like very much a huge part of my life. And along with that, you know, I originally studied something completely different in undergrad. I was an international relations major. And I transitioned into nutrition partially because of running. I just saw what a big difference nutrition made in my running and in how I felt throughout the day and the level of energy that I had. And so I really wanted to be able to do something that was going to help other people and educate them about something that's everywhere, everybody eats, everybody has to eat, but you know, there's a lot of information out there about nutrition, and a lot of it is not very good information. So it just really blossomed out of my interest in running and fitness, and now I work full-time as a dietitian. So
wow, that's a very good journey to get you here to what you're doing, because you have the athletic background, you've run, you've trained. And you have all your personal anecdotal experience along with your clients and your patients. So this is really good. And nutrition is one of those things, Holly, that there's so much misinformation out there. There's so many fads. There's so many things that, just like we talk about Coach Google and Dr. Google, there's nutritionist Google, or the misinformed guy at your group run who's giving you bad advice. So this will be good to jump into some of these topics.
Yeah, not only is there misinformation out there, but some of it is just, I mean, scary what some of, especially some of my younger runners, what they can get into on the internet as well. And that's why I try to do, I mean, we always think about running as being just this simple thing, but it's not. And nutrition is a huge part of it. You have to show up fueled, hydrated, and ready to run. And then you got to get started as soon as you're done. So, yes, it is an ever ongoing conversation and cycle that helps sustain us as runners. So, yeah.
So, Kristen, I want to jump in. We're just going to toss some topics at you that that we've seen you talk about on your Instagram feed, or also, and then there's some others that are just hot topics that we hear a lot about, if you're ready to get started on that.
Yeah, sounds great.
Great. One thing that was really interesting that Holly and I were talking about is you talk a lot about sustainable fueling and nutrition versus not sustainable fueling and nutrition. Can you dig into that a little bit and tell us what you mean by sustainable versus not sustainable?
Yeah, absolutely. So one thing that I really emphasize with my clients and with any athlete that I talk with, frankly, is just how important it is to develop a way of nourishing yourself that is going to last you through different life changes and through different periods of your life. So, you know, a lot of times I talk to people who have been trying out a certain diet. Maybe they decided to go low carb for a while, or they decided to try intermittent fasting or something like that. And they did that with a goal in mind. But ultimately, that particular way of fueling is difficult to maintain because it requires a lot of restriction. It requires a lot of depriving yourself of foods that you really love. And it isn't always serving you well, depending on what your training goal is. So, you know, you are going to need to make some adjustments to run like 60 miles a week, as opposed to running 20 miles a week or doing a lot more cross training. There's going to be different things involved with that. But the baseline of your nutrition should be pretty consistent throughout. So you shouldn't have to make sweeping dietary changes every 2 months or constantly be resetting and starting over.
So when you say that, not sustainable fueling, but it's more like a sustainable way of living, like a way of eating, right? So you're talking about making choices that can last for months, if not years, for the rest of your life, right?
Right. I mean, really, ideally, everybody would have a relationship with food that would allow them to, you know, see it as a neutral thing that they can make adjustments to as they need to without the emotional side of it. Now, obviously, that's not true for everybody. There's a lot of emotion wrapped up in food for a lot of people.
Yeah.
But, you know, ultimately, like, usually the best thing is to be able to maintain a pretty consistent baseline of your intake no matter what you're doing. And that includes those fun foods that maybe you might be more prone to restricting. If you can find a way to fit those in on a regular basis, you're much less likely to then cave and overeat when you're presented with the opportunity.
Yeah.
So if we were going to look at a sheet of paper, on the left, we've got a couple of bullet points of sustainable fueling and nutrition, and the other side is the not sustainable. What would be some of those common things in each column that might resonate with some of our listeners?
Sure. So sustainable fueling is going to involve a wide variety of foods, typically. It's going to involve less restriction, so not trying to cut things out or like no long lists of foods that you're not allowed to have. It's going to involve regular meals and snacks, particularly when it comes to fueling before and after your runs. And it's going to involve a pretty good balance of things. So like you're going to see some salads in there. You're going to see some salmon in there. You're probably going to see like a burger in there or a chocolate chip cookie or whatever your thing is.
Now you're talking.
unsustainable fueling is going to look pretty much the opposite. It's going to be probably low in energy, so like low calorie foods. It's probably going to have a long list of foods you can't eat or things that you know are not allowing yourself to have ever. It's going to look like probably you're going to have a lot of issues with like binging or overeating. A lot of times that happens at night and like cravings and things like that. and you're probably going to not run very well because you're probably going to feel like tired or something like that all the time.
This is turning on lots of lights here, light bulbs. So the bad side of the page, the not sustainable fueling, is what we hear many runners doing. Mm-hmm. I can't have that. I need low cal. I need to cut my calories, my daily intake. Restricted eating is the norm, right?
Yes. Yeah, that's absolutely true. I would say, especially in this culture in America, restricted eating has become very marketable and popularized, but that doesn't mean that it's healthy.
Well, and it leads us to the chronic issue of being underfueled, which is what we're concerned about with our runners, correct?
Yeah, definitely. So, like, if you are training for a marathon, like, you should not be restricting your caloric intake. Now, that doesn't mean, like, eat whatever you want. Obviously, like, you still make choices that make sense for your fueling, but you're setting yourself up for an injury, for a bad race, for not seeing adaptations in your training if you're constantly counting calories and not letting your body have what it needs.
Yeah, I've been trying to flip the conversation with my runners and calling it, because I've gotten some pushback in recent years about, you talk about food too much. You talk about food too much and turn it into fuel. Like, it's not food. I'm talking about fuel so that you can show up in and, you know, every day and do the work. Because when somebody comes to me and they've got, you know, two or three bad days in a row, that's one of the first questions I'll ask them is, what's your food? How are you fueling yourself for this? And it is, they just, that restrictive stuff where they just, you know, just the bad. That's a hard thing to break through with people. How do you do that? How do you break through with people, with your clients that come in and say things like that?
Well, I think especially with the endurance athlete population, it is really helpful to tie the concept of nutrition to the concept of your running goals or triathlon goals or whatever they might be. The fueling is what is actually getting you to the point that you want to be at. So if you want to run a sub-4 marathon, and you know that you're going to have to do tempo workouts for that, or you're going to have to, you know, increase your mileage to do that, you can't ask your body to do that on an empty tank. So you have to, as you're increasing what you're asking of your body physically, you have to increase what you're giving it in terms of fuel to support that training. Because as y'all know, as running coaches, recovery is where you actually benefit from the training. If you can't recover properly, you're not going to get fitter. And you can't do that without food.
Yeah, that's we find that as, from the running coach perspective, that's the biggest challenge, is getting people to go easy enough on the easy days and put as much focus and attention and obsession on their recovery and refueling. But this restrictive versus non-restrictive, what I didn't hear was the bad side of the ledger. It wasn't junk food and pizza and a cookie and a hamburger. It was underfueling, and not that's interesting, because you would think that the bad column is all the stuff that we like, and that's not it at all.
I mean, you know, like, there are people in the world who eat a lot of food that is, you know, very calorie dense, very high sodium, lots of sugar on a very regular basis. And certainly, like, that is kind of a lack of balance on the other side of the spectrum, right? Like, that is, you know, something where adding more fruits and vegetables and whole grains and fiber, those things are going to add benefits for those people. My runners, most runners are not going to eat that way. And, you know, usually people don't feel very good when they eat that stuff all the time. So what happens more often is that you restrict those foods and then you end up overeating them later because you feel scared of them. You feel like you don't have control around them. And actually, when we add those things in a way that makes sense for your training and in a sustainable way, those foods don't have as much power over you, so you're probably likely to eat less of them. You just eat them, you enjoy them, and you move on. You don't have to eat an entire box of cookies just because it's there, because you can have a cookie whenever you want.
Kristen, one thing that we hear a lot around the holidays, around vacation, is I'm going to eat less to make up for missing some workouts, or I'm going to eat less because the holidays are coming, or I need to count my calories today so I can enjoy my party tomorrow. Talk about how that is such a flawed strategy.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things wrong with that approach. One thing is that it is not how biology works. Your body cannot, like, take, you know, if you eat 1,000 calories at one meal, your body is not going to hold on to those so that you don't need to eat for another, you know, 18 or 24 hours. You still are going to get hungry a few hours later because that's how your body works. That's how it processes food. So the idea of saving up calories or making up for what you burned off, that's really just not very good science. But on top of that, it kind of puts in this mindset of that you have to earn your food, or that you can't eat if you don't run, or, you know, that your body can't handle eating something that may not be the most nutrient dense food. And that's really just a lack of trust in your body, because your body can use those foods just like it uses foods that you might think of as healthier. A burger still has carbs, fat, and protein. It's still going to break down in your body the same way, and it's still going to be used by your body as fuel, just like it would be if it was a grilled chicken sandwich on whole wheat. And at the end of the day, you know, we never have to earn our food. We all need food to survive. Yeah. You do not have to be a runner or work out at all to eat. You still burn calories just by being alive, because that's how your body keeps you alive. Food is a necessary element for survival. So it's not a question of whether you ran enough to eat. Either way, you need to eat.
Yeah, that's a... you just... So many feelings about stuff like that, just because it is. It's so, you know... Why do you have to earn your food? You know, I just, that all that mindset just, it just, I don't even, I don't even know what to say right now. It just baffles me, you know,
yeah.
The idea of the restriction, and, you know, I'm running 10 miles tomorrow, so I'm going to do all this. You know, it's just, it goes back to that idea that you said about, like, just have a sustainable diet that works for you, that, and that matches with your goals. Like, if my goal is to run a half marathon or a 50K, I eat food because I have to eat food because I have these goals that I want to accomplish. There's no earning in that mindset at all. How do you battle that? Like, is that the idea that because you work mainly with athletes, like, you have this goal and you have to do these things?
Yeah, I think it depends a little bit on the individual and where that attitude is rooted. Sometimes it's linked to weight. Sometimes it's linked to, you know, a lot of anxiety around food. Me personally, you know, if you run with me and you make a comment about that, like, I will probably call it out in person and just be like, you don't have to earn your food, because I'm really big on that. But it's just a matter of reframing, like, why you're fueling, why you're eating, and recognizing that food is fuel, but it's not only fuel. Like, you can still, like, enjoy a barbecue on the 4th of July, or like your parents' Thanksgiving dinner. That's an opportunity for connection, for community. It's enjoyable. It's fun. And limiting yourself because you didn't run a turkey trot in the morning, you know, don't do that. You can still enjoy your Thanksgiving turkey and have fun with your family and enjoy that community. Your body can handle that.
Yeah. So much of this resonates. As a coach, it makes perfect sense. As a runner, it's bouncing around in my brain. I'm like, oh man. I've stood in front of crowds of runners before and given presentations. And one topic is that I've seen so many runners self-sabotage their training and their performance with poor nutrition. So here's where we get into that. I've said it many times, and I'm not sure if you're about to correct me or change my verbiage, but so you can't outrun and you can't out-train a poor diet and poor nutrition. So where's the balance in that statement? Help me be a better coach.
So the problem with one-liners is that they don't have a lot of nuance. There's two sides of the coin when it comes to poor nutrition. If you're training for a marathon and all you're eating is fast food and Dr. Pepper and Cheetos, that's going to be a bad time. You're going to have GI issues. You're not going to train well. You're not going to recover well. On the other hand, if you're eating a lot of salads and low-carb cereal and, you know, really not eating enough calories to compensate for your training, you're also going to have a bad time. You're still not going to recover well. You're still not going to have good runs. So on both sides, I would call both of those things poor nutrition. I do think that nutrition is really important to training, and you cannot overcome nutrition mistakes just by like training more or training harder. However, I think that we have to be careful that like just because you didn't eat maybe the best thing before your run the following day, or just because you maybe had like more like foods that are more energy dense and less nutrient dense, that doesn't necessarily mean like your training is a failure or that your running like doesn't count just because you ate something else. You still are going to get nutrition from those things. So really it's just about the overall scope of your diet versus like any one specific food.
Okay. That makes a lot of sense. And I will fine tune that part of the clinic, that you can't outrun a poorly balanced, restrictive, nutritional plan. And I think especially with recovery and, you know, I guess it's before, during, and after your runs also, you can't overcome that over time. It's going to catch up with you at some point. But Okay, here's another one where I battle with, especially after trying to become a little more informed, is endurance sports, that's running and cycling and triathlon, the strength to weight ratio, super important, right? At the elite level, they're measuring it on a daily basis during the workouts. What's the strength to weight ratio? And we always get runners saying, oh, I need to lose 5 more pounds to get into racing shape, or I want to lose 7 more pounds before race day. I'm conflicted because yes, if you can maintain your strength and lose a little bit of weight, that will increase that ratio. But I know there's a tipping point personally and with our athletes where I can lose too much weight and I lose a lot of strength. So help me balance that in my head, and also how to relay that to our athletes.
So I personally really de-emphasize the concept of race weight with athletes. Yeah. I do not encourage athletes to use the scale as a measure for their fitness level. And I mean, I will say yes, like of course physics is a thing. You're right. You're going to get a lot of like elite athletes are going to be a specific body type. But I would also say like those athletes are not necessarily fast because they're thin. They're fast because they're really well trained. Genetically, they're predisposed to be that weight.
Yep.
And not so much like just because like they trained so hard, they lost a lot of weight and now they're really fast. So I always encourage athletes to focus on their training and their recovery first and foremost, and trust that their body will land where it's supposed to land. So if you're really well trained and you're taking care of your sleep and your nutrition and all of those things, you're going to run faster. However, if you focus on, I got to lose 5 pounds, well, how are you going to lose 5 pounds? Well, you're going to eat less, you're going to run more. And then it's probably going to backfire on you because you're not going to be eating enough to make up for the volume that you're running. If a weight goal is really, really important to an athlete, I would encourage them to pursue it in the off season and not while they're training for a race.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. And when we see some of those professional athletes, we don't know the choices that they've made to get there, you know?
Right.
Yep. Race weight is all relative. Well, actually, I don't even believe in that idea of race weight, but that is a tricky thing that I know that I've had runners deal with, because you're right, it is physics. The smaller you are, the faster they go, and it just messes with their head, and can lead them down a very dark path where they might be faster, but they're not healthier, and their body is crumbling.
Yeah. Well, and it's not sustainable, right? I mean, no, you might lose weight and you might be faster in the short term, but eventually if you have poor nutrition that got you there, and you're probably going to miss a lot of time with an injury or something like that.
Yeah. And like, I think that goes back to that, you know, the adage that Kevin just mentioned, you can't outrun that. Eventually this is going to catch up to you. Like I like that idea that you keep coming back to, the idea of it being sustainability, a sustainable diet, so you can sustain your health and your fitness and your running for the long term and not just a quick fix for a race.
There's so much emotional and mental attachment to this. It's such a deep issue. It's not just our weight and our performance. That's what makes it so tricky. And I know for me personally, I've gone through phases of training and racing where I was weighing myself every day. As that maturing endurance athlete, I've learned to go by how my clothes fit, how I'm performing, how I feel, how I sleep, how my joints feel, versus I haven't weighed myself in months and months and months. But back in those days, it was so mental that I would not weigh myself race week if I had a big key race, because if I was off what I thought I should be, it would throw me into it would screw up my race plan and race strategy, because I gained 3 pounds this week or whatever it was. So it's a ball and chain mentally that is so difficult to maneuver personally, and then trying to help others maneuver through that. It's just so, there's so many trap doors that you kind of get lost in which direction to go. So this is super interesting.
One of the questions that I have kind of went back and forth over the years as an athlete, as a high school athlete all the way through college, is supplements, multivitamins, things like that. What are your feelings about supplements, multivitamins, in terms of adding to our diet? Is that good? Is it bad? What are your thoughts about that?
So it depends. I would say that for most people, a multivitamin may not be necessary. Usually I try to encourage people to get more of their nutrition from their food. So that's looking at, you know, what they're eating now and what they might be able to add in to maybe make up for some of the things they might be a little bit low in. Like vitamin D is a big one. So there are foods that have vitamin D in them, like mushrooms and eggs and fortified dairy products and non-dairy products. Sometimes it is necessary to supplement, but I would encourage anybody who is interested in supplementing like a vitamin or a mineral to get some labs drawn before you do it, because there are also sometimes negative side effects associated with taking a supplement that you don't need if you get too much of that particular nutrient in your body. It is safer to know that you have a deficiency. So like, I have quite a few runners that do require a vitamin D supplement because there's not a lot of good food sources for it. And a lot of people don't spend much time in the sun, which is the other way that we get vitamin D in our diet. But that being said, you should check to see whether your vitamin D level is low before you start taking a supplement.
So okay. I can hear our listeners' hands raising out in the audience. Well, what about this? And with the laundry list of supplements that they take. So a couple of quick ones. So things like, I hear a lot about probiotics. I hear a lot about a fiber supplement. I hear a lot about electrolyte supplement. Can you hit those three big ones right there?
Sure. Okay, probiotics. There's probably not any harm in taking a probiotic supplement. It might not do very much. Those probiotics have, maybe 5,000 live organisms or something in them. And there's like 50 million in your gut. So it may not be making that big of a difference. One thing you could do instead would be to eat foods that are high in probiotics naturally, like fermented foods like yogurt or kefir or sauerkraut, anything that's like pickled, kombucha, those kinds of things. Those have probiotics in them naturally. Fiber also is a good way to make your gut flora healthier because it has prebiotics in it, which are the nutrients that those gut bacteria feed on. So fiber supplementation, again, like you can take it, it's fine, but it would probably be easier to just include more high fiber foods in your diet. So your whole grains, your beans, your fruits and vegetables, your avocado and nuts and seeds, usually if you're eating several servings of those types of foods a day, you really probably don't need a fiber supplement. Electrolyte supplements. So I would say, like, in a specific context, like if you're taking them before you go out and run in the heat, that could be helpful. Again, all of those foods, all of those nutrients are naturally occurring in a lot of different foods. So most people probably don't need to supplement like potassium or sodium. If you're eating a wide variety of foods, you may want to diversify a little bit to include more like nuts and seeds and fortified grains if you're running a little low in magnesium. But I would say, like, unless you're taking it for sport, I don't really think an electrolyte supplement is necessarily necessary.
How often do you ask your clients, whether they're runners or not, to get a full blood panel done? Is that something that you recommend?
I can't order labs personally because that's not something that dietitians do. I do usually recommend that if they haven't gotten labs done in a while, they might consider getting it done. And I think there can be a lot of value to that, particularly if they're having issues with like fatigue or frequent stress fractures or something like that. If you don't have a doctor that can run the labs for you, or if you have a doctor that doesn't necessarily know that much about sport, you could always get it through like an online provider, like an Inside Tracker type of company.
Yeah, that's why I was asking that, because I follow several professional athletes on Instagram, and they will talk about Inside Tracker or whatever the other one is, about how often they get it done. And then I work with high school kids a lot, and they just go to the pediatrician. And so I've had a couple kids this past year talk about their fatigue and what have you, and say, you know, and I'll go through all the things of what are you doing. In the end, you know, asking them to go get a full blood panel done, and it turns out they're anemic. And so that's, so I was just wondering how often you might suggest somebody doing that. Okay.
Yeah, it can provide really good, useful information. Sometimes I think people put a little bit too much value on labs because our bodies are really good at keeping us in homeostasis, which means they like to just kind of, our body likes to stay at its same level state, and it will resist change. So sometimes, like, even if lab values look normal, you may still have an issue that's linked to a fueling deficiency, but it may not show up in your labs. So I think labs can be a good piece of the puzzle, but they're definitely not like the end all be all of everything.
Yeah. I can't solve everything. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So, you know, as I've said, you know, working with a female athlete, and I've had a lot of, you know, questions come to my mind as you were talking earlier, because working with females in particular and talking about that idea of a restrictive diet, as females, as our bodies change, whether that's through puberty or through having children, that is a constant battle that we have. As, you know, I've had so many runners who have come through and say, I peaked in seventh grade. I was my fastest in seventh grade, right? And they end up making these choices in the end in high school that aren't great, because maybe their parents don't understand, maybe their coach doesn't understand, and they make these choices about restricting themselves because they know that when they were smaller, they were faster. And so what I've tried to learn more about that I'm excited to talk to you about is that female athlete triad in Red S. So can you tell us, what is the female athlete triad?
Yes. So the female athlete triad is a syndrome that was defined several years ago that consists of disordered eating, osteoporosis, and a missing period. So those three symptoms kind of combined is what make up the three points of the triad. Red S, which is relative energy deficiency in sport, is a little bit more recently defined, and it's basically the female athlete triad, but like on a broader spectrum. So Red S includes male athletes as well as females, and it includes a wider array of symptoms, because the triad, kind of like, to be diagnosed, you have to have all three symptoms, and sometimes people have one or two, but they may not have the third, or they may have other symptoms, like they may have a lot of anxiety issues or GI disorder, cardiovascular issues. So it's kind of a broader array of symptoms that can be associated, but the underlying cause is the same. It's a lack of adequate energy to make up for the demands of sport.
Okay. To me, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, one of the biggest red flags in this, and what conversation I've been trying to have with my runners over literally the last year is their period, which is what people don't want to talk about. That there's shame involved in that. There's embarrassment in that, because I see that when I think about that female athlete triad, the importance of the period. Can you talk about that and the importance of it and why it's so key for a female athlete?
Yeah, absolutely. So when somebody starts missing their period, so that's more than either it never started in the first place, or you had it and then you lost it and it's been more than 3 months since you got a cycle. That's a big red flag. It can sometimes be an indicator of a different serious health issue that has nothing to do with sport or fueling. But it can also be an indicator of what's called secondary hypothalamic amenorrhea, which is just a fancy scientific diagnosis for your period is missing and you used to have one. That is a result of an energy deficit. Basically, your body is in a very stressed out state, and it has consequently shut down the part of your hormones and all of the functions that control the reproductive cycle. So that cycle is non-essential to your survival. So in an energy deficit, that's one of the first things that the body's like, okay, like this is not a priority. We don't need this. We're going to focus on like keeping your heart going and your liver working and your brain moving. So we're going to shut down the reproductive system. So you're not making the hormones that would direct that cycle. And that is bad, A, just because that usually is like a big red flag that can have long-term consequences in terms of your fertility.
Yeah.
But also it has consequences in terms of your cardiovascular health, in terms of your GI function, and in terms of your bone health.
Your bone health,
which is a big one because that one is not always reversible.
Yeah.
So usually if the athlete starts eating again, maybe taking a step back from the intensity of their activity, doing more stress management, you can restore a missing period. You can reverse some of the cardiovascular damage from that. But bone health, especially for athletes that are still young and developing, that one is a big problem because we really reach peak bone mass pretty early on in our lives in like our 20s and 30s. So if you have poor bone mass then, it's not going to get a lot better. So it's really important to maximize it when you're a developing athlete so that you don't have a lot of injuries later on, so you don't have osteopenia or osteoporosis later on in your life.
Yeah. I wish this is something that I had known about as a kid. I played college soccer, and I remember conversations in the training room and outside about, I think half of us didn't have a period. And not understanding and not having anybody around us, because we're 18, 19-year-old kids who are, we're not talking about it, number one, with our man coaches, right? But not understanding how big of a deal that was for us at the time and how it has impacted us in the future. So I have a question about that, because I know that there are some people who, you know, they'll lose their period and they'll take birth control to get it back. Mm-hmm. What do you think about that? I think I know what you're going to say, but I want to hear the professional say it.
Yeah. So this is honestly something that is a big misconception, even in certain parts of the medical community now. You cannot use birth control to restore a missing period. The reason for that is because the way that hormonal birth control works is that it gives you artificial hormones. So if you, let's say you have a normal cycle and you take birth control, well, you're still getting those hormones. And when you get a period at the end of the month, there's no medical reason for you to have it. It's just because you're taking those placebo pills or whatever, you know, you took out your ring or whatever birth control you're on. It's just a withdrawal bleed because your hormone levels dropped when you stopped taking those pills. So we're basically not correcting the underlying issue if it's an HA person. Your getting hormones, but your body's still not making them. So until you correct the fueling issue, and the ratio of strenuous exercise to the amount of energy that you're taking in, it's not going to fix anything. It's not going to restore your fertility, or your period's not going to get like jump started by starting on the pill. It's basically just going to mask your symptoms.
Yeah, that's exactly what it's just artificial, and you're not, and you're still doing the damage to your bones and cardiovascular that you're just masking that again. But I think that's something that a lot of people don't understand. They think, oh, I'll just take birth control. I think a lot of parents, I mean, I've had runners who will say, oh, my mom just put me on birth control to do that, and not understand what's causing it.
And to be fair, a lot of OBGYNs also recommend that as like a first line if an athlete is missing her period. And I have certainly had clients who came to me and said, my period's missing and I feel like something's wrong, but my OB/GYN said it's just because I'm active and everything's fine. So there is a lot of misinformation out there. And for athletes that are dealing with that, or athletes that are wondering if that's okay, I would really recommend that you seek out a physician who works with a lot of athletes and who is well-versed in treating cases like that, because it is never, ever normal for a girl or a woman to be missing her period from too much activity.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. Okay. And so I mentioned earlier about the anemia, and I see that in more female athletes than I do in men. Mm-hmm. Do you see that a lot? And I mean, I know diet can prevent it. So what do you do with people who, you know, to kind of combat that condition that they might be in with anemia?
Yeah, so it is really common, and more so in women than men, and especially in athletes who participate in like a high impact activity. There's a couple of reasons for that. Women need more iron per day than men. Particularly pregnant women and women of reproductive age. We also are going to experience increased losses of iron, both through our menstrual cycles as well as from sport through sweat and GI losses. And then when you're pounding on the ground over and over again, it tends to break more of your blood cells. So that's another reason that we tend to be, athletes in general tend to be a little bit lower in iron. From a dietary perspective, usually it just involves increasing your intake of iron-rich foods. So that's going to be like your meat, your chicken, your fish, your beans, your leafy green vegetables, fortified grains, all of those, molasses, all of those foods are high in iron. Women need about 18 milligrams a day. If they're of reproductive age, if you're pregnant, you need 27 milligrams a day. So a lot of women that are pregnant do have to supplement. And I have often seen women that have a severe iron deficiency have to supplement that as well. But again, that's an issue that I would definitely get a lab first.
Yeah.
Because you definitely don't want to be taking an iron supplement if you don't need one. They're hard on your GI system.
I was diagnosed with anemia twice, once in high school and once in college. And yes, taking some iron supplements.
Yes.
You need some extra fiber in there.
The liquid ones tend to be a little bit easier on your body, so I'll sometimes recommend those. You can increase the absorption of your dietary iron by pairing it with a source of vitamin C, so like orange juice or tomato sauce or something like that.
Okay, let's just keep on with this then. So I have runners who will talk about, and it's different for every girl. Okay, and it depends, and there really is no rhyme or reason to it, about how having your cycle impacts your running, and what should we be aware of on our cycle while we are training for a whatever it is that we're doing, and should we change our diet during that time period?
So this is a topic that has gotten a lot more traction recently. It's kind of an emerging area, and part of the reason for that is because most of the sports nutrition research for the last, however long they started doing sports nutrition research has mostly been done on men. Yeah. So it's only recently been something that's really been addressed. And I do have to shout out Stacey Sims, who has done a lot of work. She's a PhD in New Zealand, and she wrote the book Roar, which I'm sure a lot of your listeners have read. She's done a lot of work on publicizing this as like an issue and something that women should be aware of. Yes, I mean, essentially, your hormones are doing different things during different periods of your cycle. So, like, for example, when you're in a high hormone phase, which would be usually a couple of weeks before your period starts, your body is less able to access stored carbohydrate. So typically, if you're exercising at a higher intensity, you want to increase the amount of carbs that you're eating overall. It's also a little bit easier to get dehydrated because your blood volume is low and you're losing more sodium. So you really want to keep an eye on your electrolytes and your hydration. And usually your energy needs overall are a little bit higher during that period. So you might find that you need to eat a little bit more in general just to kind of maintain and prevent feeling like really hungry.
Okay. What if you had to think about, so I got, you know, I've coached your high school all the way up to people who are in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. Is there any specific advice that you would give to a teenage female athlete in terms of nutrition? Something to think about.
I would say, you know, definitely pay attention to your bone health. Get your vitamin D and your calcium, whether that's from dairy or from something else. That is really, really important for teenagers to maintain their bone health, to build it to its peak capacity, and to maintain it for the rest of their life and prevent stress fractures and those types of injuries, which do tend to be a little bit more common in those populations, especially at competing at a high level. And I would also say, you know, that's a time when your body is changing, and that can be a really hard transition for some people. This is not necessarily like a specific nutrition tip, but just to be patient with your body, to accept it instead of fighting against it. Do not waste your teenage years trying to lose weight and dieting. There's so much more that you can do with your life other than that.
Yeah, 100%. And that's what I try to tell the kids is, you know, we might have one person who went through puberty and they still look like this. They look a certain way. And we have somebody else whose body has completely just curved out. Mm-hmm. And they want to, you know, and this is what their body does. And to be able to accept it and love it and do what you can with it and not try to fight to be like the other person who maybe isn't as curvy. That's one of the things that I have to battle with coaching these younger people. And two, you know, what you just said earlier about, you know, most of the research has been done for men, and a lot of men coaches who maybe coach cross country or track, and they will coach the boys, the girls, the same way that they'll coach the boys, and not understanding what female bodies are going through, the changes that they're going through. And that's what causes girls to, you know, do the restricting and to make the choices. They're going to fight it in whatever way that works. And that's usually the way that they fight it. Oh, thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. So what about females as they get older? Maybe I'm 44. So somebody, as we get into our 40s, any advice for a female athlete as we've gotten older?
Yeah. So, I mean, one thing that I will say that just continues at any phase of life is, you know, just like when you're a teenager, like there's way more to life than dieting and trying to be a certain weight. I would say that to everybody that's an adult female runner too. You do not have to fit into the pants you fit into in high school. You do not have to be the size you were in college. Your body is the body that you have, and that's the only one that you're going to get. So the best way to make yourself a quality athlete is to train that body and fuel that body the very best that you can. I think that in terms of nutrition, you know, for women that are maybe still at a reproductive age, I see a lot of women like cutting carbs and trying to avoid certain types of foods that are like so-called bad foods. I would say, you know, I would not do that, especially if you're a runner. You definitely don't want to be messing with a low carb diet. It's not going to help your running, and it's probably not going to help your weight either. Because if you don't get enough carbohydrate, your body is probably going to think that it's not getting enough fuel overall, and it's way more likely to store fat rather than burn it all off. So it's not going to accomplish the goal that you think it is.
Yeah.
When you get into kind of premenopause, menopause, it's really important to focus heavily on your protein intake and maintaining that lean mass. You still need your carbohydrates, you still need your fats, but I definitely encourage those athletes to focus on protein intake so that they can maintain their muscle mass even as their hormone levels are changing, and it becomes a little bit harder to do that.
Okay, let me ask, as a man who has a wife who's a runner, daughters who are athletes, I coach age group females of all ability, and I also coach teenage girls at a school level. What advice can you give me to better understand and navigate all of these complex issues that have it's a completely different world than coaching the men.
Mm-hmm. I think it's really key to be sensitive to the way that girls' bodies change as they head into puberty. It is different than coaching guys. So I think being sensitive to that and not coaching all of your athletes the same, male or female, is really important. You might also find that your female adult athletes maybe respond a little bit differently to different fueling practices than your men. One great example would be like fasted running. So that was super popular maybe like, 5-10 years ago. I definitely know coaches that still make their athletes do fasted runs. I personally would not recommend a fasted run for a female athlete, particularly because of the way that our body will respond by breaking down more muscle, storing more fat. It makes it much harder to train at intensity for a longer period of time. Your time to fatigue is quicker, and it does not have a benefit to performance. So some male athletes may find that helpful, but for women, I would not recommend it.
Good.
And have a good female assistant coach. For your younger people,
and
right?
Hire women when you need to hire coaches. Yes.
Surround myself with really smart women. I've become pretty good at that as I've gotten older. That's the key to success.
Who can talk about periods with athletes
and understand
you.
It, right?
Yes.
So there's a tightrope because I don't understand it. I'm certainly sensitive to it, and I see it, and I empathize, have empathy for it, but I need an expert who can understand and relate to that person. Mm-hmm. As a male coach, it's super intimidating, and I have to be very careful to not come up with my boilerplate solution that I would come up with for any runner. This is a special case, and I guess the first step is just being super alert and aware, and like you said, a key word is sensitive to all those issues.
Yeah, and just really focusing more on like how your athlete is training, how they're progressing in their training versus a specific weight or a goal like that. And that goes for men as well, certainly. Eating disorders are not a women-specific diagnosis. A lot of men also have disordered eating or eating disorders. But particularly for your girls that are teenagers or like trying to, maybe get into competition at a collegiate level or something like that. There's a lot of pressure in that sense. And I think it's really important to affirm who they are, who they're becoming, and that they're maybe confused about their body and what changes have happened to how they're training, but without saying like, oh, well, you need to lose 5 pounds or, hey, you really need to lean out a little bit. Those things can be extremely triggering for kiddos at that stage of life.
And I had my kids read an article last year talking about this, and two of them literally cried and said, I've never felt so seen. Because mm-hmm. It's this like that knowledge of understanding what's happening to them and knowing that it's not their fault. That it's just who they are and what their body is becoming. And and how much of a relief that was for them to understand that. So I love this topic, and I'm just trying to learn more about it. I do want to ask you, because I do feel like this is something that a lot of people don't understand, the difference between disordered eating and an eating disorder. Can you explain that as a professional?
Yeah, that's a great question. So eating disorders are a formal diagnosis. That's things like bulimia nervosa, anorexia nervosa, binge eating disorder, atypical anorexia nervosa. So that's somebody that has been diagnosed by a medical health professional. Those manifest in different ways. Sometimes they involve binging. Sometimes they involve purging. Sometimes they involve extreme dietary restriction, or maybe restriction of only specific food groups. It's not a formal diagnosis, but it's kind of a concept that's become very common in the eating disorder world. And I see it a lot in athletes called orthorexia. So again, it's not a formal diagnosis. It's sort of similar to anorexia nervosa. Instead of restricting foods in an attempt to lose weight or an attempt to eat as little as possible, you focus only on eating things that are clean or things that are like approved foods. So you just want your diet to be very, very pure. So that can be another manifestation of what I would call an eating disorder. Disordered eating, on the other hand, is dietary behaviors that are restrictive, that compromise your ability to fuel properly for your sport, but they don't necessarily have to be part of like an overall pathology. So that might mean calorie counting. It could be that you have a rule that you never eat after 8 p.m. It could be intermittent fasting. It could be like restricting certain food groups from your diet for a non-medical reason. Like if you avoid gluten, but you don't have celiac disease, then gluten doesn't really bother your stomach. It could be like always eating your foods in a certain order, or like eating very small portions or something like that. So you may not have like the full-blown disorder, but you are engaging in behaviors that are leading you down a path that could turn it into an eating disorder long-term.
Got it.
By the way, that could also manifest itself in things like compulsive exercise, like if you can't take a day off, or weighing yourself every day, or body checking in the mirror. I would consider all of those to be disordered behaviors related to food and body.
No, that's
Holly,
yeah.
She's talking to me, isn't she, Holly?
Do you weigh yourself every day?
No, not anymore.
Okay, good.
Wow. Such a deep, complex topic.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's jump on a few quick hits here, Holly. Can we go there now?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right, Kristen. So we get questions and comments, and we're talking to our runners all day, and we get these different things that jump out. And one thing I hear all the time is, boy, I do a good job all day, but then I crash and burn in the evening and after dinner with snacks on the couch. How do we respond to that?
So there could be a few things going on. A lot of times when people tell me that they have a snack issue in the evening, it's because what they think is doing a good job all day is probably not eating enough. So if you are eating like a yogurt for breakfast and a salad for lunch, and then you have massive sugar cravings at night, it's because you're not eating enough carbs.
I guess it depends on what you consider a good job in the day, right?
Yes.
I might think yogurt and a salad is a good job. Look at me.
Yeah.
What was the last nutritional article you read on the internet, and now you think you're doing a good job?
Exactly. So that's definitely a big part of it. And the fix for that is to eat more during the day, particularly with carbohydrates. So all of your meals, if you are a runner, all of your meals should have carbohydrates in them. No salads that do not have a source of carbohydrate. No, like, eggs and bacon with no carb on the side for breakfast. Like, you need carbs. That is what your body runs on. It is non-negotiable. The other thing that can sometimes happen is if people get into a place where they are just kind of, like, maybe bored or, like, not really, like, paying attention. Sometimes they will like grab a bag of chips or something and sit on the couch and like, hey, the whole bag of chips is gone. And that can happen because like a food like that, like chips or, you know, Cheetos or whatever it is not a very satisfying snack. So it's really easy to eat a lot of it and not feel any less full. If that is your problem, then I would recommend maybe picking a snack that has multiple types of food. So like maybe it has like a starch and a protein, like peanut butter crackers, or like a yogurt with some fruit, or carrot sticks and hummus, whatever it is that's satisfying to you. And maybe paying a little bit more attention to what you're eating. So maybe like putting it in a bowl or on a plate, or not watching TV while you're eating it, tuning in a little bit more to how you're feeling, so that you're not just like sitting there eating because it's something to do.
Yeah. Yes. I also hear, I eat too much. I really love food. I wish I could control my appetite. Other end of the spectrum, right?
Yeah. So, oftentimes, when I hear phrases like that, it kind of is coming from a place of like guilt. Like they feel like they should be eating less, or they're trying to maybe stay under a certain calorie number for the day. And they can't quite figure out why they're always so hungry. And I always tell people like your body is very, very smart. So it knows if it needs more fuel. And if you are feeling hungry, that is a sign that you need more food. So if that is a problem, if you're constantly feeling hungry, then you probably need to think about adding a little bit more food into your day, whether that's eating a little bit more at your meals or maybe adding in some snacks in between your meals if you're not. And then again, you know, I think it's great when people really love food. I think that's like such a great quality to be able to love food and enjoy it and have fun with it and really savor all of those things. So I would think about maybe reframing that idea of like, my appetite is bad and food is a bad thing and I should be eating as little of it as possible, to this is a thing that is helping me to get to where I want to be with my athletic goals. And it's something that I really enjoy and it's something that my body needs, and that's okay.
This really reminds me of when we get a runner and they keep missing their goals and they keep getting injured and they can't figure out why. And we take a look at their training log over the last 6 months, and to us, it's crystal clear. Oh my gosh, here's exactly what's happening. Most of us need a really talented, qualified nutritionist, dietitian. Can do the same thing, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely don't think like everybody needs in-depth nutrition counseling, but it could certainly be beneficial for a lot of people, especially if you have a complicated relationship with food, or if you struggle to see food as a positive for you, or if you are like having a lot of recurring issues, and you know that training is not the issue. It's oftentimes it could be a fueling issue.
Yeah, we talk a lot on here about what it means to be a dumb runner. That's one of our more popular episodes, is literally dumb runner. So what are your top three dumb runner comments that you get when it comes to trends about food and nutrition and what have you?
Gosh, I feel like there's a wealth to choose from.
It's an endless yeah. list, but what are the three most popular, or the ones that make your skin crawl the most?
So one would be when somebody brags about how little they ate during a training run or during a race. That is just
dumb.
That
dumb.
So much. Yeah, it's dumb. Just because you can run 20 miles on no fuel does not mean that you should, or that that was the best that you could have run.
Oh, that's okay.
And I will die on that hill. Let's see. I would also say, like, when a runner decide they're going to try like a low carb diet or keto or intermittent fasting or something like that, that's really kind of counterintuitive to like the nutrients and the timing that you need as an athlete. It really just like kind of throws a wrench into like how you're going to fuel well for your training efforts, how you're going to recover well. If you're not allowed to eat until 11 in the morning, but you run at 7, then probably going to have a hard time recovering properly from that workout.
What do they think is the science behind intermittent fasting? What is it about that?
You hear that a lot right now. Yep.
Yeah. It's, I think it has been shown to potentially have some benefits when it comes to like weight loss, and things of that nature. Generally speaking, the reason for that is most likely going to be because it's calorie restriction. So it's not any better or more effective than any other calorie restrictive diet for weight loss. It's just set up in a different way. So, I mean, I intermittently fast for 7 to 9 hours every night when I finish dinner and then when I get up in the morning. Yeah. And your body definitely does need breaks from eating. However, usually the reason that intermittent fasting works is because you have fewer hours in the day, so you just can't eat as much food.
All right, what's your third? You gave us two. What's a third?
Okay, third. I would probably say using a marathon or like a goal race training cycle as a way to lose weight. I think you will see that happen, especially with newer athletes, just because their body is adapting to a high training load. But the fitter that you are when you start, the harder it is for you to continue to see those adaptations.
Yeah.
And like I said before, you're basically like pulling on two opposite ends of a rope and it's going to break in the middle. Like training on one side, calorie restriction on the other side, they do not go together. So that is a mistake. And I wish that people would stop doing it.
that's a good one. And we tell people all the time that if you think you need to lose some weight before your goal marathon, we do it in the off season, because once we get into the training, we're not counting calories. We're not restricting our diet. So that's
right.
Yeah. Those are good. Those fall right into the dumb runner list, Holly.
I know. So what is your favorite post-workout food, post-run food? We always ask people this one.
I am a big fan of chocolate milk. I think it is easy on people's stomachs usually. It has a really good mix of carbs and protein. It's got a good amount of branched-chain amino acids in it, which are really important for muscle rebuilding. So I think that's a pretty good, easy choice. If it's a meal, I run in the morning, so I always eat breakfast food after my runs. So like, you know, I'm a big fan of like eggs and potatoes. Potatoes are a really good post-run food. They are really high in glucose, which goes straight to your muscles. Mm-hmm. So I love that. But I'll also do like Kodiak cake, pancake cups and oatmeal and smoothies and things like that too.
Well, if you run in the morning, what do you eat before you run?
Usually I eat like a waffle or half a bagel with a little bit of peanut butter on it.
Yeah.
That's just what works for me and my stomach. But I also would recommend like, sometimes I'll eat like a banana. Orange juice can be a good option too. But I always eat something, because you should always eat if you're going running in the morning, because you're fasting.
We have practices in the mornings during the summer, and they show up with no food. I'm always, y'all, you've got to eat something. Get your system going.
Yeah. Well, it's not even that. It's because your cortisol levels are elevated, and if you don't eat, they're just going to get more elevated, you're going to have a less effective training session.
Absolutely.
Well, Holly, there you go. That was a deep dive into nutrition and fueling, and I certainly learned a lot. Dispelled a lot of myths that lived in my head as a runner, but also as a coach, and a different way to look at some things.
100%. I can't wait for people to take a listen to this. I told a couple of my female athletes yesterday that's what we're doing, and they were super pumped to hear from a female nutritionist to give them some help.
Yep. Kristen Fant, the endurance nutritionist, tell us how that we can follow along and get in touch.
Yeah, so you can find me on Instagram. That's where I do most of my social media. It is @endurance.nutritionist. And then you can also find me on my website, which is kristenfantnutrition.com. And if you are interested in any of my coaching programs or anything like that, you can find that information on my website as well.
You're based out of Dallas. Do you do any coaching long distance? In this day and age, now that we're doing it?
I do, yeah. I actually coach most of my Dallas clients virtually as well, so yeah.
Good. So I encourage you all to go follow endurance.nutritionist on Instagram. It's really, really interesting and well-done content, and you'll learn some things there. So, Kristen, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Don't forget that you can go to iTunes and hit the subscribe button and leave us a review. Please do that. And you can reach out to us at coach@can'tstopendurance.com, and we're on Instagram and Facebook as well. And let us know if you have any questions. If there's any questions that came from this episode that you want answered, maybe we'll have Kristen back on, if she'll come back on. And because this is an ever-evolving and just continuing conversation that we all should be having about nutrition and sport. But as always, Kevin, what do we say around here?
Run smart, train hard, and race fast.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.